Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Zinsberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir, but where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm lucky to have as my guest Greg Jackson. He's just published his first book of stories. It's called Prodigals. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. The first story in this book, Prodigals, is a story called Wagner in the Desert, and it appeared in The New Yorker and created shockwaves. It's a sort of radioactive story, and the editor of the Paris Review said it was the most extraordinary thing he'd seen in The New Yorker in 20 years. It's really quite an introduction to the work, but it's only an introduction. This is a book of 8 stories. It's called Prodigals. There is no title story, so Prodigals is the theme. How do you define prodigals?
Prodigals, it's very interesting when you're putting together a short story collection, because I think you usually don't necessarily know that you're writing a short story collection when you write the first stories. So I was in a position of realizing partway through the process that I had not only a book here, but a book of stories that hung together, that belonged together. And I was trying to think about what it was that brought them together. And a good exercise to try and figure that out is to try and figure out what a title might be for this book. I hadn't written all of the stories at that point. And I was thinking of titles, and ultimately Prodigals was what came to me. And it came to me for a few reasons. I think one of the subjects that this book takes up is certainly upper middle class life in America right now, specifically for people who are younger and are trying to figure out how to structure their lives, what is important, what is not important, and how to make a viable life based around those judgments. And I was particularly taken with people who I felt a kinship with, who saw something in the privilege that they were given or born into that was both unattractive in the sense that it wasn't something that was available to everybody, but it was also unattractive in the sense that it burdened them with a notion that they were supposed to be able to find fulfillment, able to make their destiny, to find what they wanted to do in a very straightforward and easy way. And so I saw these characters, a shared quality in them being that they wanted to somehow escape their heritage, escape their privilege. They wanted to strike out in the way that we do to try and make our own identity.
You know, the first story is very wild, about young people who, before they have their first child, they have decided to do every drug they've ever thought of doing and have the wildest time that they can confect before the dawn of responsibility, parenthood. Others there are about to take their first boring jobs. They all know this is the end of something. And this book seems to say, well, good for them, but if we're going to be artists, if we're going to write real stories, you don't blow it all off and go to serious parenting and a job in a bank. The rest of the book are stories that kind of are looking for the invisible something that will keep a writer alive when you don't have any more the excesses of youth to rely on. Am I right?
Absolutely, and I think I don't want to disparage or run down in any way the sort of decisions that many of us make, are forced into, or feel ourselves forced into. There are very practical considerations in life, and those are hard decisions to make, and thank goodness that many people grow up and assume certain responsibilities in their life. I think that's not possible for everyone. Literature, as Bolaño, who's an important writer to me, who I love, has said, literature
Roberto Bolaño.
Yes. Literature should be a dangerous calling. Art should be a dangerous calling. And part of the reason it should be dangerous is that it forces you to question everything. And it forces you to question especially the things that you can't see, to treat the immaterial, the spiritual, the side of life that's concerned with meaning as equally important to the side that's concerned with preserving your body, preserving your lineage if you have children.
So the second story has a world-famous tennis champion. He doesn't like to play anymore, and he takes the narrator of the story and videotapes him in the role of a tennis champ.
Right.
And from that day on, this man loses his fiancée, loses his own sense of hidden worth. It's as if to enter the world as a champion is to lose the quest of being. Is that sort of...
I think that that's right. I think it's even beyond being a champion. It's in some way to find celebrity, to find being observed, listened to, or paid attention to believe that that is going to be the spiritual satisfaction that you're looking for is a mistake, and ultimately probably winds up being almost a kind of expropriation of some part of your soul. And I think that's what you see a little bit in that story, in the idea of video, which we describe, the verb we describe when we talk about video is to capture. And there's something in the capturing of this person that the tennis pro has felt and now this journalist feels. It's a kind of Faustian bargain.
I'm talking to Greg Jackson. It's his first book, a book of short stories called Prodigals. Now, as we move along, the stories get, it seems to me, more and more complex. Gradually, we get introduced to the characters and their backgrounds. They're mostly wealthy. They're young people who do not necessarily have to work for a living. The longest story is a story called Meta-Narrative Breakdown, and it's as if now we meet a young narrator. Is he even named?
No, I don't even think he is explicitly gendered, although I'm willing to go along with the idea that it's a man.
And he has a friend who goes by the name Misty, but the name she was given is...
Mirabella.
They've come to the house where their grandfather is dying.
Yes.
There's the sense that whatever the grandfather is, he's someone who understands that life needs an anchor, but the anchor may not be attached to anything at all, and that questing is not necessarily a questing for something. It's an ongoing process. Now, would you do me a favor and tell me in the simplest language you can what a meta-narrative breakdown is?
Sure. I think that that is a perfect reading of what the story is trying to get at, I would say, first. And a meta-narrative, to begin with, is the idea that there is something that sits behind narrative that separates narrative from, let's say, a litany of facts. If you were to just list random events, we would not say that's a story. We would not say that's a narrative. The meta-narrative is this idea of something that all narratives share, that is the property that makes them narratives. And so the meta-narrative breakdown is a moment when, or a crisis when, your own ability to put what's happening to you into the story of your life fails, and you can't take what you have available to you in the present and marry it to the past and understand that there's an ongoing story that makes sense. And it's in these crisis points that, in a way, you achieve something perhaps a bit terrifying, but you also achieve a clarity or a wakefulness that you might not before, because it wakes you up to the idea that you have been telling yourself a story.
The book seems to go through, story by story, a loss of identity. Gradually, as you suggest, you're not sure of the gender of the speakers of the story, or you may learn it late on into the story. There's a lot of ambiguous and ambivalent sexuality. It seems to be that the goal of the story is to take characters to a point where they no longer know themselves, and where they're aching for whatever clues to identity they can find around them. Would you say yes or no?
I would say absolutely. And I think you alluded to earlier something that I explicitly did in this story, which was to structure the book somewhat as a progression and as something that in small ways deconstructs itself, partly by becoming more formally experimental in questioning narrative and narrative assumptions, but also having that mirror characters question their own identities and their own sense of self. And one of the ideas is that maybe in these crises, you actually are more aware of yourself. You're more, there's a truth in the crisis that is more profound or real than there is in the kind of daily flow of your life.
Just so you'll see where this begins, I'm going to ask my guest, Greg Jackson, to read the opening paragraph of the first story, the one that threw everyone into such a tumult when it appeared in The New Yorker. This is Greg Jackson reading the opening of Wagner in the Desert.
Wagner in the Desert. First, we did Molly, lay on the thick carpet, touching the pile, ourselves, one another. We did edibles, bathed dumbly in the sun, took naps on suede couches. Later, we did blow off the keys to ecologically responsible cars. We powdered glass tables and bathroom fixtures. We ate mushrooms, ate and waited. Then we just ate, emptied Ziplocs into our mouths like chip bags. We smoked cigarettes and joints, sucked on lozenges lacquered in hash oil. We tried one another's benzos and antivirals, Restoril, Avadar, Yaz, and Dexedrine, looking for contraindications. We ate well, cassoulets, steak frites, squid ink risotto with porcini, spices from Andhra Pradesh, Kyoto, Antwerp. Of course we drank, pure agaves, rye whiskies, Saint-Germain, old scotch. We spent our hot December afternoons next to the custom saltwater pool or below the parasols of palm fronds, waiting, I suppose, to feel at peace, to baptize our minds in an enforced nullity, to return to a place from which we could begin again. This was a few years ago in Palm Springs, at the end of a very forgettable year.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm, today from the studios of NPR West. I'm talking with Greg Jackson about his book of stories, Prodigals. We'll continue after this short break.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. You can listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Greg Jackson about his book of stories, Prodigals. Stories that delve into the inner journey of today's seemingly prodigalist people of privilege. Now, that place of enforced nullity in order to return to a place from which we could begin again, that's where these characters, somewhat interchangeable, have arrived by the last story. The beauty of the diction is constant throughout, but the stories become more and more difficult, more opaque. They want to see to the bottom of life. If they begin as people who believe in nullity, this becomes a book about people who want to find some kind of truth in nothingness, or to consider it as a foundation of life?
I think back sometimes to Nietzsche's, I believe, his first book, The Birth of Tragedy, which sets up a really interesting dichotomy or dialectic, where you have the Apollonian, which is the kind of rational, the idea of light, clarity, enlightenment, rationality, and you have that juxtaposed with the Dionysian, which is kind of ecstatic, literally in the original sense of standing outside the self, and that believes in a folk wisdom in which it may be better actually not to be. And it has an idea of a kind of a dissolving of identity that allows you to join with other people. And Nietzsche's idea was that in marrying these two and finding some synthesis, this is where Greek tragedy, Attic tragedy, found its greatest flowering. And I think that for me, both of those are important. The clarity of these characters' self-understanding in some way is not at odds with, at some point, reaching a part of themselves that is completely opaque. The clarity does not necessarily lead to clarity, but maybe leads to further confusion. At the same time, I don't think that it is quite a nullity. I think sometimes what's happening is people run up against the mystery of themselves or the mystery simply of things. And I think that there's a wonderful kind of dignity to that, to the belief that there is a level of mystery that's not nothingness, but maybe is somewhat impenetrable. And I think that's somewhat what's happening, although I certainly agree with you that a deconstruction of identity is a consistent journey that these characters undergo.
In one of the stories, you do something that I have never seen done before. These are very strange stories. They're stories, I think, in which you're trying to talk about some aspects of your generation that don't get talked about. And so the question is often, who am I? Driving home through a storm, a man picks up a woman who he calls Susan. We are led to believe that she's his psychoanalyst. But as the story proceeds, she might be his wife, who is a psychoanalyst, and he might be projecting onto his psychoanalyst the qualities of his wife. But more than that, we gather that he treats both his wife and his psychoanalyst as his mother. And so the question is, who was he with in this car in the middle of the storm? And the answer is, it could be any of these female presences in his life. And I've never quite seen projection become the subject of a story. We don't know who the characters are. Character is mystery. How did you figure out how to do this? How did you arrive at this?
Well, first, I'll just say that is the most perfect description of this story, Dynamics in the Storm, that I could imagine. And I hope if I ever have to describe it to anyone, I can remember verbatim what you just said. I almost don't want to say more because that is perfect. And part of there's so much a desire in writing these stories to leave, to work with what is intuitive to me, what makes sense to me and feels right, but to leave a lot of those questions quite open to the reader. This was a very hard story to figure out technically how
to do. That's what I think, yeah. These stories choose to do in fiction things that are technically so difficult that I've never seen them before. How willing are you not to be understood? I mean, I'm the bookworm, so I'm right. Going to read these things until I understand them. I don't think that it's fair to read a story and move on without understanding it. But these are really complicated, and they grow more complicated as you move along. Yes, they are all stories about homecoming. Yes, they are all stories about coming to a place where you can start afresh. And the last story, most of all. I see the progression, but I'm wondering, you know, the reviewers are very taken with you. I think they love your writing, but I don't think they understand you. Are you prepared for a lifetime of that?
I put a great deal of trust in readers, and I think one of the really tricky things to calibrate as a writer is that you want to write something that draws people in on a first read. You don't want people to put down a book, but you also want to write something that people want to return to. And I spent a huge amount of time in the revision process trying to put in enough that there were ways and handholds within the story to understand them and to get down to what, at least I thought, maybe was really going on. Now, I guess I have to accept that not everyone is going to pick up a book in the first place, and a lot of people who pick up a book are not going to read it twice. But I really wanted to write stories that would reward a second reading, and I wanted to write stories also that the quotient of truth to me felt greater than my own ability to capture and trap that truth.
One of the characters in the last story says to the other, "You're still speaking in terms that are post-structuralist, and you should stop doing that once you leave grad school. that at most you have 2 or 3 years grace period. They have a debate about whether it's a grace period or something else. but this is a book in which someone is still talking in the language that is embodied by deconstruction. And it's as if everyone around him wants to say, grow up, accept the real world. The meta-narrative breakdown is part of your imagination. Enter reality. Well, what are you going to do about that, Greg Jackson?
I'm not unfamiliar with people in my life saying things along the lines of grow up. I think part of being a writer is trying to not fully grow up, not grow up into the idea of accepting all of the stories about adulthood and being able to look at adulthood sometimes with the defamiliarization of a child's eye. But yes, you're right that perhaps this book asks certain things of readers, and it may even risk alienating some readers. But at the same time, what I see as one of the great gifts, great discoveries in a book that you can have and that I've had with a few writers who've meant so much to me, is that they have made using my mind and being awake to my mind more exciting than all of the things we do that are quite routine, quite run-of-the-mill, that are quite easy. And to make thinking hard and thinking rigorously as exciting as watching television, that's the dream.
I've been talking with Greg Jackson, author of Prodigals, a book of stories published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. Very interesting stories running from the most obscene to the most philosophical. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's been such a pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Prodigals at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director at NPR West here today is Theo Mondel. Our usual technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to NPR West and to David Sobel, my assistant. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Christopher Sorrentino is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.